Well, hello everyone. Hope you all had a good week. Mine's been kind of crazy. Telling some people earlier today that this Mr. Mom thing is adding to everything else I have going on. So having to shuffle kids around and of course take care of the stuff I'm responsible for has been quite a stressful week. Plus preparing for sermons. So I had my hands full this week. My yard is like this tall. So I haven't had a chance to get out there and do it. So hopefully I can tomorrow, but we do have some news about Sandra's health, but it's in an announcement, and Mr. DeMore will be reading that here in a little bit. Well, brethren, the fall holy days are right upon us, and it's hard to believe that we'll be leaving for the feast here in less than 2 weeks. And I love the fall holy days because it's such a positive time, you know, looking forward to the kingdom under Christ's rule. And we know that prophecy shows, by representation, the Day of Atonement and other things that go on, that we have some hard times ahead of us, you know, prophetically speaking. But yet, the end result will be a world that mankind has never experienced, and that is one truly under Christ and under His rule. And that's something that we all look forward to. One without sin, without death, without Satan's influence. And of course, it's Satan's influence that has always wreaked such havoc on the world, you know, on nations, in churches, among people, even among brethren. So in 2 days, we're going to be experiencing the Feast of Trumpets. And of course, that's the time that represents the time when Jesus Christ will return and begin His campaign to claim the earth. And we know that that is symbolically gestured by the blowing of trumpets. And that is a symbolic announcement of His return. We also know that there's more symbolism in that blowing of trumpets. There are other reasons why a trumpet would be blown, and one of those is a trumpet of alarm or warning. So, brethren, we know that this is still Satan's world. And don't you know that he just has to hate, probably more than any of the other holy days that we have, he probably just has to hate the Day of the Trumpets more than any of them, because it represents the time when he will be deposed. And I'm sure that's why it's not uncommon for us in the church at this time of year to have trials and troubles that come on. It seems like it always happens around feast time, doesn't it? If something's going to go wrong, it's going to happen right around the Feast of Tabernacles. See, Satan will love nothing better than to destroy us, to cause us to fail, because we represent those that, quite frankly, will be replacing him in the future. And there are some very effective tactics that he uses. And there's a couple of tactics that I'd really like to focus on today that are especially effective that he uses to cause division among us. Did you realize that Satan can actually use our own zeal, our own dedication, our own commitment to him against us? He can use it to turn us against one another and turn us away from the truth. And it's a very effective strategy. It's a very real tactic that he uses. Another tactic that he uses is getting us to follow some idea or cause or movement, something that we feel that is so important that it is worth whatever the cost, whatever the price, whatever the fallout, whatever the collateral damage. He is able to convince us sometimes to follow these things. For all time, Satan has used religious zeal and religious fervor to create all kinds of havoc in our world. And one of the most commonly recognized events in history that people use to point to this are the Crusades. And today I'd like to talk about the Crusades a little bit, because there's a very interesting parallel to events that occurred then that still plague us as Christians today. Now, the Crusades were a series of wars that happened between the 11th and 13th centuries, about a 200-year period. Now, these wars were proposed and encouraged by the Latin or by the Catholic Church. The first pope to encourage one of these wars was Pope Urban II in 1095 AD. Now, there are varying views of the Crusades. Historians disagree somewhat on the purpose and intent of these Crusades. But one of the most commonly held beliefs is that these wars were driven by Christian greed, by lust for power, by the desire for wealth, an excuse to invade, to conquer, to kill, and to plunder, all in the name of Christ. And while it is true that there were some horrible things that happened during the Crusades, that wasn't entirely true, including, unfortunately, the murder of some thousands of Jews, actually, that happened during the Crusades. Not to mention the killing of innocent men, women, and children of other faiths, predominantly the Muslim faith. Now, some believe that the average crusader was gluttonous. He was a greedy individual. He was selfish. An individual bent on personal gain and personal glory. That they didn't truly believe and they didn't truly live by the religious tenets on which the Crusades were supposedly based. Some believe that the Crusades were unprovoked aggression by the Western world. But as with history, the popular view isn't always the most accurate. And I'd like to spend a little time today to go into some detail on some of the historical aspects of the Crusades, to paint a picture for you, to explore what motivated the Crusaders. Because there are some very interesting parallels between the life of a Crusader and our lives as Christians today. The dictionary definition of Crusade, as defined by dictionary.com, is this. Any of the military expeditions undertaken by the Christians of Europe in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries for the recovery of the Holy Land from the Muslims, or number two, any war carried out under papal sanctions. And then number three, which we'll spend quite a bit of time on, is any vigorous, aggressive movement for the defense or advancement of an idea or cause. See, although the Crusaders were deceived and they were misled, I intend to show that they were devoted to their cause, that they believed in their mission, and they truly believed that God was on their side. Likewise, we as Christians, if we're not careful, we can get caught up in a crusade, fully believing that we are in the right, that God is on our side. So for the remainder of my time, I'd like to look into the mind of a crusader, and let's see just how easy it is to get caught up in something that looks so right, yet can be so wrong. Now, I'm sure many of you have heard the historical version of the Crusades that I've mentioned here. Hollywood loves to portray the Crusades in that light. I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Kingdom of Heaven, starring Orlando Bloom. It's a good movie, but it also portrays the Crusaders as evil opportunists seeking their fortune in the Holy Land. Even Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama described the Crusades in this manner and even offered that as a reason for the hatred the Muslims have for us today. But some of these commonly held myths are not entirely accurate. I'd like to quote for a little bit for you today from a website called ChristianityToday.com, The Real History of the Crusades. They have this to say. With enormous energy, the warriors of Islam struck out against the Christians shortly after Muhammad's death. They were extremely successful. Palestine, Syria, and Egypt, once the most heavily Christian areas in the world, quickly succumbed. By the 8th century, Muslim armies had conquered all of Christian North Africa and Spain. In the 11th century, the Seljuk Turks conquered Asia Minor, modern Turkey, Asia Minor, which is modern Turkey, which had been Christian since the time of St. Paul. The old Roman Empire, known to modern historians as the Byzantine Empire, was reduced to little more than Greece. In desperation, the emperor of Constantinople sent word to the Christians of Western Europe, asking them to aid their brothers and sisters in the East. Now, I picked this website, ChristianityToday.com, as the one I would quote from, but there are several others that also relate similar ideas about this portion of history. That the Crusades were indeed a response to the aggression of the Muslims, not an excuse by Christians to conquer and plunder, as some would provide that as a reason. They considered it a responsibility of all Christians to come to the defense of their fellow Christians who were being overrun by Muslim armies. Pope Innocent III, which was the successor to the previous pope, whatever his name was, said this, "How does a man love, according to divine precept, his neighbor as himself, when knowing that his Christian brothers in faith and in name are held by the perfidious Muslims in strict confinement and weighed down by the yoke of heaviest servitude, he does not devote himself to the task of freeing them? Is it by chance that you do not know that many thousands of Christians are bound in slavery and imprisoned by the Muslims, tortured with innumerable torments?" So, in contrast to the politically version of history that we see, They did believe that they needed to come to the defense of their fellow Christians. This was the driving force of the Crusades, not an excuse to get material wealth. In fact, the truth is there wasn't much wealth to be had. Participating nations such as England, France, Germany, Spain, some of those, had to actually heavily tax their citizens in order to fund these efforts. There wasn't a lot of wealth to be had. It's not like they could have gone out there, conquered the nations around them, because at that time they didn't have oil. At least it wasn't accessible. It wasn't usable if it was accessible. So there wasn't money there. There wasn't wealth there to fund these campaigns. So they had to fund it out of their own treasuries. And many times that meant taxing the people. In fact, individual lords and knights often lost their fortunes self-funding these efforts. They actually spent their own money to do this. Not to mention the risk of death. Some estimates show that up to 75% of the crusaders never returned home. So it was very risky. It wasn't a cakewalk. So if they didn't do it for money, why did they do it? What was their motive? Quoting again from the same website, they said this: scholars have discovered that crusading knights were generally wealthy men with plenty of their own land in Europe. Nevertheless, they willingly gave up everything to undertake this holy mission. Crusading was not cheap. Even wealthy lords could easily impoverish themselves and their families by joining a crusade. They did so not because they expected material wealth, which many of them already had, but because they hoped to store up treasure where rust and moth could not corrupt. They were keenly aware of their sinfulness and eager to undertake the hardships of the crusade as a penitential act of charity and love. Europe is littered with thousands of medieval charters attesting to these sentiments, charters in which these men still speak to us today if we will listen. Of course, they were not opposed to capturing booty if it could be had, but the truth is that the Crusades were notoriously bad for plunder. A few people got rich, but the vast majority returned with nothing. Now, naturally, it would be naive to suggest that all the Crusaders who volunteered, and they were all volunteers, there was no draft or state-sponsored war, they were all volunteers. But it would be naive to suggest that they were all pious and holy and went with the best of intentions. Certainly, not all the volunteers were wealthy, and no doubt many of them went in the hopes of obtaining wealth. Or perhaps they went for the adventure. Or in the case of England, if you went volunteered in the Crusades, you could actually avoid the Crusade tax. And so there was some of that as well. But the idea that the Crusades were driven by greed, by lust for power, by a desire to conquer a peaceful people, it just doesn't hold water. That's just not the reason that they went. Now, all that being said, I don't want to suggest that the Crusades were justified, only that those involved truly believed that they were, that their intentions, at least initially, were honorable. But being well-intentioned does not mean that they were justified. It does not mean that they were in the right. It does not mean that they had God on their side. In fact, their battle cry was, Dux vult, which is, God wills it. I think it's Latin for, God wills it. That was their battle cry whenever they went into battle. That was their reason, their justification for going into the Holy Land. So was it an honorable thing for them to want to free their fellow man from the tyrannical rule of another faith that persecuted them and killed them for their own faith? Absolutely. That would be an honorable thing to want to do. But as with most human endeavors, what started out with good intentions didn't end up that way. There were some very horrible atrocities committed during the time of the Crusades, during that 200-year period. For example, as I mentioned before, there were literally thousands of Jews that were killed by overzealous Crusaders, even en route to the Holy Land, over more than one Crusade. So that begs the question, what did the Jews have to do with it? No, exactly. They didn't have anything to do with it. They didn't have anything to do with the stated purpose of the Crusades. Their known enemy were the Muslims. But some of the Crusaders became blinded to the objective, and they lumped in any faith. They lumped in anyone that disagreed with them, that was not in agreement with their own, and classified them as enemies of Christians. Some considered the Crusades to be the worst atrocities committed on the Jews up until the Nazis did it in World War II. Ultimately, 1.7 million combatants and innocent civilians were slaughtered during the 200-year course of the Crusades. Historians disagree as to the degree sometimes, but when Jerusalem and other cities were taken by Christians, some of the historians say that the entire inhabitants were killed or enslaved by the Christians. Synagogues and temples were burned down with hundreds of innocent people still inside them. Now, to be fair, these deeds were not encouraged nor sanctioned by the Catholic Church. In fact, they were strongly condemned. But they happened nonetheless by people who thought they were doing God a service. So, do we think that God was pleased with this? Was this His idea? Was this His intention? It's even been stated by some historians that even the very need for Christian protection, which was the stated purpose of the Crusades, was somewhat exaggerated. That while the persecution did exist and did happen, the vast majority of Christians were allowed to live in peace in the Muslim community. Not to mention that the basic beliefs that lured the volunteers to join the Crusades were based on lies. See, the Crusaders were told that if they joined the Crusades, at least they were told this by the Catholic Church, their sins would be forgiven. And if they died in battle, they were assured a place in heaven. Of course, neither of those concepts are biblical. Yet that's what they were promised by the Catholic Church, who had no authority to promise such things. Only Jesus Christ can offer salvation. And in His Word, nowhere does it state that you can achieve forgiveness for sins through war and killing. So even though the purpose of the Crusades was well-intentioned, number one, the need for it may have been exaggerated. Number two, those involved didn't restrict their involvement to noble causes. And in fact, some horrible things were done in the name of God. And number three, the promises of redemption from sin and assurances of eternal glory were all based on lies. So my point is that even though they thought they were doing God a service, even though they thought they were engaged in something holy and good, the reality was is that they were not. So like the Crusaders of old, in our zeal to serve God, we can sometimes get carried away with our ideas and causes. Remember the dictionary.com definition of crusade: any vigorous, aggressive movement for the defense or an advancement of an idea or cause. Of course, we don't fight with swords and spears. We don't have the violence, you know, nothing to that level. But we can sometimes become so fixated on what we believe God's will to be that we can lose focus, that we can become blinded to the reality of the things that we say and the things that we do. Satan is a master at creating division. And we're about to keep the Feast of Trumpets when we know that represents the time when he's going to be put away. But he is a master at creating division, always has. And the sad thing is that he actually uses our own zeal and our own good intentions against us. It's one of the tools in his arsenal he uses to divide us. Is it possible for us to be very well intentioned, to fully believe in a cause or idea, yet be fully deceived, lured into thinking that we're doing God a service, but in reality we're not? I think the Word of God, which we'll get to shortly, and history, even recent history, as little as 5 years ago, shows that it can, that Satan can actually prey upon us and use our zeal to serve God and deceive us into thinking that our words and actions are justified because we think God wills it. You know, I don't know if you, I'm sure you've noticed this before, but there's something about religion in general, almost any religion. When human beings feel that God is on their side, it emboldens them to do or say things that they probably normally would not. It grants them permission to ignore common sense, to ignore common decency, sometimes even to ignore a sense of right and wrong. When religion is justified, when religion is involved, people justify their actions because they feel like they have a stamp of approval from the ultimate authority. Look at what the followers of Islam do in the name of their God. And I won't even get into the things that we know that they do when they think they're serving their God. Look at what Christians have done in the name of their God. Now, does this mean that religion is bad? Not at all. What it means is that Satan is a mastermind at creating confusion at all levels. He can even take religion, which is something that's supposed to be pure, something that's supposed to be good, and twist it and deceive people into doing wrong. So we should ever be mindful of his tactics and make sure that all that we do and say is actually God's will. How can we do that? How can we ensure that we're not deceived in the same way, similar to what how the Crusaders were deceived. We can do that by following the example of Jesus Christ. See, Jesus was not a crusader. He was a peacemaker. His life, his actions, his words, his teachings, everything about him all pointed to a life of living with peace with others. And there's only a couple of times that I can recall where Jesus ever had to do something different, where he lost his cool, so to speak. And that was the time when he threw the money changers out of the temple and when he was combating some of the teachings of the Pharisees. Those are basically the only two times that he ever went on a crusade, if you will. But again, he was God, and there were things that he had to do. But nothing in his instructions to us lead us to be anything but peacemakers. Now, that's not to say that there are times that things might have to be addressed, things might have to be done, but that's another sermon all in and of itself. But Jesus was not, nor did he instruct us to be crusaders. He never instructed us to go on the attack. He didn't instruct us to defend ourselves. In fact, he taught just the opposite. So with that in mind, please turn to Matthew chapter 5. We're going to be reading for our first scripture, Matthew chapter 5. We're going to read verses 38 through 45. I'm going to be reading from the Common English Version. And this is something that we're very familiar with, but Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 38, says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you that you must not oppose those who want to hurt you. If people slap you on your right cheek, you must turn the left cheek to them as well. When they wish to haul you to court and take your shirt, let them have your coat too. Give to those who ask, and don't refuse those who wish to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, you must love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who harass you, so that you will be acting as children of your Father who is in heaven." Sometimes being a Christian does require suffering for righteousness' sake. It does require turning the other cheek. Sometimes when we think we've been wronged, or we think someone else has been wronged, or there's some kind of injustice going on. And sometimes we have to ask ourselves the question, and I really think this is a very important question that we should always ask ourselves whenever we're faced with these situations. Is now the time to speak, or is now the time to pray? I think if we would often pause and ask ourselves this question, we might often choose praying over speaking. But is now the time to speak, or is now the time to pray? And the answer to that question can be very tricky. Because Satan can use our zeal, he can use our enthusiasm, he can trick us into thinking that we must speak, that we must act, you know, we must defend ourselves, or we must try to combat something that we feel that is going on, because we're in the right, because God expects us to stand up for righteousness' sake. James had some very good advice on this subject. Let's turn over to James chapter 3. We're going to be reading verses 13 through 18. And he has a really great way of putting this that I think we do well to listen to. James chapter 3, beginning at verse 13, says, "Are any of you wise and understanding? Show that your actions are good with a humble lifestyle that comes from wisdom. However, if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, then stop bragging and living in ways that deny the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes down from above. Instead, it is from the earth, natural and demonic. Wherever there is jealousy and selfish ambition, there is disorder and everything that is evil. What of the wisdom from above? First it is pure, then peaceful, gentle, obedient, filled with mercy and good actions, fair and genuine." And this is the part that I really like right here. "Those who make peace sow the seeds of justice by their peaceful actions." Those who make peace sow the seeds of justice by their peaceful actions. Very wise words, brethren. Everything we do, everything we say, every action that we take, our motivation should be one of peace, from a posture of humility, not going on the attack, not starting a crusade, but as it says in Romans 12, verse 18, "As much as it is possible, live peaceably with all men." See, we live in a world, brethren, that doesn't care so much about peace. It's very easy, and a lot of people do it, to speak out, to say things about others behind the safety of a computer screen. There's a segment of our society that thinks that it's okay to riot, to burn, to loot, to steal other people's things when something happens that they don't agree with. where people feel it's okay to disrespect authority, to challenge at will, to impute motive when we don't know everything, all the facts about a situation. And add the element of religion to a debate, and it takes on a whole new life. That's where Satan can really get to us, brethren. So we must be very careful. We must not allow ourselves to be deceived. We must not fall into that trap and become a conduit for division. So this is one of the ways that Satan gets to us. Another very effective tactic that he has is having us get caught up in a cause or a movement. Paul warned us that at the end time, this would be a big problem for God's people. Let's turn over to 2 Timothy chapter 4. We're going to read verses 2 through 4. And this is Paul talking to Timothy, in which he's giving him a little bit of warning. Paul was wanting to do that. He often wrote to Timothy about things he needed to look out for. But 2 Timothy chapter 4, beginning in verse 2, says, "Preach the word, be ready in season and out of season. Convince, rebuke, exhort with all long-suffering and teaching. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but according to their own desires, because they have itching ears, they will heap up for themselves teachers, and they will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables." There are so many ideas out there. Each one has a little bit of truth mixed with a bunch of lies. Yet people fall for that stuff. You know, they go after this idea. No, this is the truth. They go this direction and no, this is the truth. Back and forth, chasing this idea and that idea until they somehow come up with whatever hodgepodge they think works for them. Let's turn back a few pages to 1 Timothy chapter 1. Read verses 3 through 6. 1 Timothy 1, 3 through 6. Another admonition from Paul to Timothy. "When I left for Macedonia, I asked you to stay behind in Ephesus so that you could instruct certain individuals not to spread wrong teachings. They shouldn't pay attention to myths and endless genealogies. Their teaching only causes useless guessing games instead of faithfulness to God's way of doing things. The goal of instruction is love from a pure heart, a good conscience, and a sincere faith. Because they miss this goal, some people have been distracted by talk that doesn't mean anything." And that's what these things are, brethren. They're a distraction. A distraction by Satan to confuse us, to misdirect us, to actually take well-intentioned, good, devoted people to the truth and turn them away from the truth. And he is quite successful at it. So we should be very careful not to become distracted by these things, by these ideas, these causes, these movements. It's so easy to become so polarized on an issue that we lose proper focus and the issue becomes much bigger than it should be. Anytime we think we need to take up a cause or an idea or a movement, we should always consider the effect that our words or actions have on people. Will my words be unifying or will they cause division? Is this a time to speak or is this a time to pray? Is this a time to go on a crusade? Or is this a time to be discreet? Above all else, the driving force in everything that we do or say, all of our actions, should be for peace. Living our lives as peacemakers, not as crusaders. Let's turn over to Ephesians chapter 4 for our last scripture. Ephesians chapter 4, we're going to read verses 1 through 3. Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. It says, "I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love," and I love this part, "endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." Endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. It's God's Spirit that unifies us, but it's the peace of Jesus Christ that binds us together. It is the glue that holds us together. See, the majority of the crusaders, they were decent human beings. They were well-intentioned. They were self-sacrificing. They were willing to give even their very lives if necessary to do what they thought was God's will. They truly believed that they were doing God a service. They truly had a zeal to serve God. But in their zeal, they fell prey to one of Satan's tactics, who used that zeal to cause terrible things to be done. They were deceived. They believed a lie. So brethren, God has not called us to be crusaders. He has called us to be peacemakers, to love our brethren. And we should never lose sight of that. We should never fall into the trap of division and controversy of causes and movements and these things that keep coming up. Because it causes us to lose the proper perspective of where we need to be, where our heads should be at. So as we head into the Day of Trumpets and into these fall holy days, let's look forward to the time when this world will finally be rid of Satan's influence and under the loving authority of Jesus Christ. And let's observe these feast days with joy, loving our brethren, and enjoying the peace that binds us together.